Welcome to Leaders Under Fire in Sports, brought to you by Culture in Sports. This is where leadership decisions, organizational culture, media pressure, and legal realities collide. Your hosts are legal expert Bob Boland, myself, crisis communication specialist Jeff Chatterton, and with leadership and culture expert Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. Together with our special guests, we break down the moments that put sports leaders under the microscope and what it really takes to respond with integrity, accountability, and impact. This is Leaders Under Fire in Sports.
Welcome to the podcast, and welcome to a topic that's kind of near and dear to me. I'm going to work through this in the next half hour or so because it relates to some work I'm doing right now. I'm going to keep the case quietly into the details, but it deals with an athletic parent who may have created either deceitful or misleading evidence, or put forward deceitful or misleading evidence because their child lost playing time.
You're being too kind. They faked the evidence, Bob. Just tell the truth.
Right. Well, fake is a tough word, but certainly misled with it. And in the same time, a coach who's my client in this situation's career hangs in the balance. The case is not over, but I'm very convinced that this was entirely about the fact that the coach at the end of the day was not playing the kid enough, that the kid was upset, and that it really didn't matter what the facts were or what reality was. This coach was bad and was no longer a person. In fact, coach asked me at one point, how could they do this to me? Don't they know I'm a person? And I said, no, you're just the obstacle to their kid playing. And this has been that's repeated, repeated.
Let me set the context here. Let me just rephrase this so that everyone's all on the same page. We have a coach for an NCAA sports team who is currently suspended because one of the player's parents fabricated, juiced, made up some allegations, and made up some really kind of crappy video evidence that they probably shouldn't have because it doesn't support the narrative. Is that a fair summary?
A fair characterization. Misleadingly framed video evidence.
Yes.
And use it to support a conclusion other than that. In my mind, possibly actionable under tortious interference with contractual relationships and possibly false light defamation. So those are things
that's
code
for you want to get them in trouble for lying.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I don't. And here's the thing. My coach didn't deserve this. And here's the third thing. In asking about this with the institution, what's the comeback? And the answer is, much like Mr. T in Rocky III, we don't hate the kid. We pity her that the experience was taken from the athlete to get better, to work through this situation, which is why today's episode on the pod is about why deal with adversity if someone else will take care of it for you. And it's a way to diffuse, particularly, and because our audience in a lot of ways are leaders in sports, coaches, athletic directors, and others, but also parents and athletes, we want them to be able to sort of give some guidance to what a toxic situation is that's actionable and what an uncomfortable, adverse, or difficult situation is, and why. For a long time, every old person with gray hair or an AARP card will tell you, or they used to tell you, that adversity is good, that we're supposed to come through it. We're supposed to meet it. We're to rise to the occasion. It's part of our education. It's part of our experience. And it doesn't have to be quite as colorful as Mike Tyson likes to say. Everybody has a plan until they're hit in the mouth. But ultimately, every time we need to grow as individuals, we get to do it. I get to discuss it with you two. I get the guy who messages everything better than anybody else, you, Jeff. And I get to go to the guy who's perfect on toxic recovery or recovery in these situations. And the question for us today and the adversity question is, how do we know when a situation is really adverse or when it's merely uncomfortable and it's one that we should grow in and embrace? And how do we report things that are unsafe and differentiate those from things that we shouldn't endure, that are really, really bad? Because we recognize that both extremes exist in the world, and one shouldn't be tolerated for the sake of another. But how can those two things, how can we hold those two thoughts in our head? That's our topic today. It's a great thing for young athletes. It's a great thing for parents. It's a great thing for leaders to kind of understand what's run-of-the-mill adversity and things that are hard versus what are things that should be reported and dealt with and cleaned up.
Now, Bob, going back to the situation or the scenario that you described, nowhere in that discussion did you or Jeff talk about what the athlete had to say or what his or her feelings were about the situation if they were shared.
Yeah, and they haven't been particularly, other than there was, other than the story is told by others that the athlete was disappointed with the athlete's playing time. When the athlete's playing time ticked downward from playing a significant, about a third of the games, to playing 2 minutes and 2 minutes and then no minutes, guess what? A report was made with this, at least misleading evidence as part of it, and put the school in a difficult situation. And by the way, the evidence comes from 2.5 months earlier. It was saved up and added later. Once the playing time dropped, you can correlate it. You can see it. It's not hard to see. And for me, I feel badly for the athlete. I feel that the athlete hasn't been heard, that the athlete hasn't been coached to understand that the athlete playing isn't the outcome. It's the athlete's development in this process. So the challenge is we now basically drop bombs on one another, as opposed to actually trying to sort out why you're not playing. How do you play more? And if you stood in front of a classroom, if you've taught, if you've ever been a coach, we all of us kind of knew this. It's like, oh, coach has their favorites. Oh, coach has their unfavorites. And the answer is, I've said this many times. I bet you've said it too. You want to know how you get to be my favorite? Here's the path. And this is something that we seem to do. We seem to want to decapitate our organizations rather than empower and stand up our organizations to deal with stuff.
It's a fascinating evolution. I genuinely feel bad for the coaches out there, especially at the NCAA and the college and university level across Canada, because for years and years, for decades, the barometer on success was your one-loss record. It didn't matter if you yelled at the athletes as long as you produced results. And results was, did you win? And that's the end of the narrative. But we don't have that narrative anymore. Coaches aren't being judged on one loss record. Well, they are still being judged on one loss record, but they're being judged on, and they're being accused of harassment or abuse. It's a completely different environment that everyone is out there navigating. And so in the meantime, you've got athletic directors who are running around trying to just deal with that environment. It's kind of a brave new world without any of the bravery.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the challenges is who is going to coach in this current environment and who's not afraid of this current environment. And Jeremy, you're our expert on coaching. Tell us about your own experience in this space and tell us about how you feel entering it right now.
So there's so many feelings going on, you know, back as my time as an athlete, you know, back as a coach, back at leading national sports organizations, and to my current role as the executive director of culture and sports. So I have a lot of different roles that I'm looking at this through in a lot of different lenses. But there's a couple things that I want to bring up. The first thing is when both of my, now back then weren't adult children, they're adult children now, but back when they were simultaneously going to high school and college, once they became a college student, by the state of California's definitions, they were considered an adult in the form of education. And so I, as a parent, couldn't call, you know, the school administration at a college or university and ask them what their grades were, or about a financial aid issue, or about a payment issue in general. I couldn't call and talk to them about anything, because if I were to call, they would say, "Are you the student?" I would say no, and they would say, "Well, we can't talk to you. We need to talk to the student." And so that's one of the first things that kind of comes up is, you know, these athletes are adults. Where is the athlete voice in this situation? Is the athlete voice being stifled by the coach or by the athletic director of the school? Is the athlete voice actually being stifled by the parent because the parent wants a outcome? And the other thing I have to share is if this team was undefeated, which I don't believe they are, solely because if they were an undefeated team, or if they were winning almost all of their games and going to potentially be a national championship contender, would the athletic director, would the school actually be entertaining the situation? Or if the coach was just winning, would they even address it, or even let the parent address it? Or would they say, "No, this coach is doing a great job because they're winning"?
Jeremy, you've raised three things that probably are the next couple topics of our conversation, and all three of them deserve to be plumbed. Let's talk about, and I only have to tell a quick story on the first one. It was about 12, 13 years ago at NYU, when I was a professor, that a mother called me pretending to be her daughter and asking about her class schedule. And it was sort of like, "This is so-and-so, and I want to know about my classes." And it's like, all right, the kid's 18. The mother smokes. This is not working. I brought the kid in. I played the message for her. I go, "Are we on the same side here now? We're not at odds." So yeah, there clearly is, I can identify this. There's clearly the desire of parents to remain involved in the adult decisions of their kids. And it used to be that stopped at Little League. Then the bar came to high school and club sports. It got picked up in club sports because you paid for it. And then it moved on to college, and college coaches are, you know, and college coaches should deserve to be questioned. They aren't deserving to be immune from this. I don't know any that are perfect. We'll probably talk about that a little bit along the way, even the ones that are undefeated. And, you know, I've made recommendations to fire coaches in the past, enough so that I have credibility in the other side of the issue as to what's a venial sin and what's a mortal sin in this space, both from the Olympic movement and safe sport and other ways. So I think we have some credibility as this group. But yeah, clearly the trend has been for parents to be much more helicopterish, if you will, and want to be involved in their athletes. And some of that comes from really benign reasons. Some of it comes by the fact that, particularly in small families, sport becomes a really common point of family bonding. You know, Jeff, you've got some teenagers in your life right now. I won't say how you're doing with them, right? But, you know, they tend to pull away from us as they reach that age in certain ways. And sport is the way that families and others stay together. It becomes the bonding point. Batting average, your three throw percentage, and your block percentage shouldn't be who you are to your family.
I was quite impressed. For reference, I'm pretty open about the fact my stepson is going to go off to university next year. He's going to be a freshman. He's already made the football team. He's on the O-line. The coaching staff had a parents' night. Now, this is well before the academic year has even started, and walked us through expectations and behavior. This is what they are expected to do. This is how this works. This is your role in the process. This is how this works. And this is what isn't going to be acceptable. Now, I don't know if they got into such things like, if you don't like the fact that your kid isn't playing, and maybe that's the next step in the process. But effectively, at what point do we tell parents, go pound sand? This isn't your fight to have. Yeah.
And is there a nicer way of saying that, right?
Well, there's, of course, a nicer way of saying it, but it comes down to setting expectations, right? So these parents have been parents of young children who were under the, you know, 18 years old, under being the age of an adult for so long. And this is also a new transition for them. And so someone has to go out there and set the expectation. And if they're not, that's part of the issue. And I know as a parent, like, you want the best for your kids and you want to go out there and help them so much. You just want to fix the problem for them. But how are they going to overcome that adversity and deal with it if they don't try to navigate it on their own? And that's why I'm really interested in this situation, Bobby. And you and I spoke about it a couple weeks, well, about a week ago, is that has the athlete actually had a conversation with the coach? And if so, what was the result of it? And did that athlete, who is someone's child, did that child communicate that to their own parents? And that's what I really want to know in this, because obviously there's different sides to every story, but this actually might be an issue between a child and their parent and a lack of communication, and it may actually have nothing to do with the coach. Adversely, or conversely, adversely, you know, if this were a safety issue per se, and the athlete was trying to say something and no one was listening, we of course would want the parent to come and say something. And when I say safety, I'm talking about mental, physical, or emotional safety. You know, those are all incredibly important. And so there is a role of a parent as the athlete's support team to, you know, occasionally come out and say something. But in this case, I don't know what has happened. And I don't know if the athlete knows what has happened.
I'm going to jump in here. And so I'll back you up, Jeremy, on the we need to be able to be voices on behalf of those who we have raised when it comes to issues of physical safety and mental safety. Do we have a role, or do we need to step back and let... you mentioned emotional safety, and I'm gonna say that sometimes being offended and being upset, that's not a bad thing. That's not wrong. Sometimes, you know, there are constructive ways to offend people, quite frankly, and I think we're losing that. I think we're losing our ability to be offended yet still carry on. And that's, we all decry the rise of cancel culture. And now we've, you know, somehow devolved into creating fake abuse narratives just because our kids are upset, because they're emotionally upset. I don't know if that doesn't play in my world.
But what I'm trying to get at is here, sorry, Bob, but what I'm trying to get at here is if you look at this, is what has the athlete, this goes back to my initial question, what has the athlete said? What did the athlete feel? Is the athlete even involved in this, or is the athlete sitting back and being like, oh my gosh, I can't believe my parents are doing this? And that's what would be extraordinarily interesting, is to find out where the athlete sits on this, because nowhere in Bob's explanation of the tale, or the limited knowledge I have of it, or you, Jeff, saying what it is, no one has said anything about what the athlete has said or recalled or shared that's their problem.
Jeremy, sometimes lawyers are the worst people to figure the truth of a situation out. I will be the first to admit that. What I know from the athlete's mouth, from other people, is that the athlete basically said, it's okay, I don't care about the loss of playing time, but this doesn't improve by mid-season, my father's going to come and this coach will be gone. Those are the words from the athlete's mouth to others. What I don't think anybody's had a conversation with the athlete about, and I'm sorry we're doing this without our friend Carl Olson or Janine Dannebaugh, our sports performance psychologist, but we're doing it here for the sake of our leaders and our parents. The thing I wish were happening, that somebody was sitting down and going to the athlete in question and said, look, is the coach harsh on everyone, or are they harsh to you? Have they said that they don't want to play you? Have they been clear about the challenges, what you need to improve, why you're not improving enough, and have they given you some tools to fix it? Otherwise, that's fair critique. Those are the things that we should be doing, you know, to help us improve. As far as I know in this case, and as far as I know in other cases like this, the coach is just trying to find their way to put the best players on the field, put the best players out there, and to help them grow into a way that wins. Somebody who I don't always agree with once said, "I don't know any coach who purposely didn't want to play the best players," and they may decide who the best player is with some bad judgment along the way. There certainly racism has been a factor. Family background can be a factor. Wealth can be a factor. All those factors can be. But you know, I don't know anybody who purposely tries to lose as a coach, and I think that's a fairer assessment. But I do think the question is, has anyone talked to the athlete about what they're losing in this process? That they're losing a chance to be coached, that they're losing a chance to have actually overcome adversity or deal with an adverse situation and get better. And are we doing that to a generation? Are we piling on? Jeff talked about cancel culture. And my view of cancel culture is some people definitely needed to be canceled. They needed, you know, Harvey Weinstein, a great example, didn't need to be canceled. He needed to go to prison. That was exactly where he should have been. Epstein, in prison. But we never figured out what was a misdemeanor in this area. We never figured out what people could come back from. And one of the challenges now is we have parents, athletes, others, dropping bombs on coaches who are well-intended, who've chosen to make a career in this area, and who maybe messed up or maybe aren't quite the effective communicator that they'd like to be. And as opposed to helping them get better, we're just saying we'll blow them up and we'll start again. And that's one of the concerns I have athletically, because, you know, nothing ever came. Like a bad athlete went to the Olympic trials in wrestling, played two sports in college, but still pretty bad athlete here. And the idea that I endured that because it was hard said everything about what sports meant to me. It was hard. It was work. And sometimes I sucked at it. But that was the part that's enabled a part of my character in later life that's helped me kind of work through this in a way. And are we depriving kids of that opportunity if we involve ourselves? Because adversity is a lot of the way. The obstacle is the way is a famous book. But the idea that the adversity that we go through is a test of our character later. And I don't know any, we've got three fairly middle-aged white guys talking here, but I don't know any of us not experienced something worse in life but we couldn't look at it through the lens of sport. I talked about this with a friend who I played football with in college a couple nights ago, that my own divorce in midlife was a way for me to use the experience I had as an athlete to think about how I came back, how I got myself back together, how I avoided blame for this, that I took the lessons of hard and put them into my life to try to get better. And I did a lot of work. I mean, yeah, I drank a few martinis and occasionally did some things that probably were not totally productive. But one of the things that we have in the society is kind of this magical idea that it will get better. There's a magic bullet. There's a bomb. There's something we can do that will make it better. And the answer is that's seldom the way. The hard work is the way. And that's one of the challenges I think we're taking out of sport. Sport is hard. Running is hard. Lifting is hard. These things are challenges. Swimming is really hard and can be boring unless you find a way to deal with it. 1650 swimmers will tell you it takes a lot of mental work to get through those flip turns. But the idea is, why are we destroying this for people, and aren't we talking about it? Not to say that we shouldn't have safe sport, not to say that we shouldn't have these good outcomes, but the idea that we need to think about these things a little more difficultly.
Well, and this is where everything is hard. You know, being an athlete is hard. The challenges that you encounter are hard. That's where overcoming the adversity comes in, is the hard is the adversity. And if we're taking that away as parents of adult athletes, or as parents of of youth athletes or just parents of youth in general, if we're eliminating those opportunities for learning and growth and overcoming that adversity, we're doing a disservice to those people. And if we're doing a disservice to college level athletes by not letting them encounter that adversity, we're literally taking a learning opportunity away from those athletes, not only for their whole lives, but literally for the game that they're playing or the event that they're training for. Is, you know, what if a bug hits a runner in the face while they're jumping a hurdle? Like, are they all of a sudden going to be like, oh, I need to rerun the race because a bug hit me in my face? You know, that they need to learn how to overcome that adversity. And I think sometimes it's very difficult for what may be considered an overbearing parent in this case, where an athlete may not have as much stake in the situation or want as much stake in the situation that the parent has.
Carol Lawson, who's the basketball coach at Duke, who played for Pat Summitt at Tennessee before that, made the comment of doing hard better. That the goal of being an athlete is to handle hard things better. Now, that can sound a lot like a motivational speech, but it's a great attitude to understand that we're going to face a lot of adversity in the choices we make, and the more we can do that and the more we can withstand it, the better off we are through this one. I want to talk, Jeremy, I want to ask you, and Jeff, you're in the role of a parent right now. Jeremy, you've been in it, but you've also been a coach. Is there a message that we can give to parents about this that gives them some perspective on this that they might listen to for a minute?
Well, I think they need to take the cue from the athlete, because the athlete may not be sharing like fully what they want as the outcome. You know, maybe they're afraid of interacting with the coach for a very specific reason. Maybe the coach is abusive, you know, verbally or physically, and that's why they don't want to encounter the coach. Or maybe they don't want to encounter their parent because they're afraid of disappointing their parent. Maybe they have made clear to one of their own parents that they don't want to play sports anymore, and the other parent like insists that the child should play sports because that's the last connection they have with that child. And so there's so many different lenses to look at this through, but with everything that I've heard and seen in this situation, I honestly think that there needs to be an honest discussion between the parents and the child in this situation. I think there needs to be an honest discussion with the coach and the athletic director and a advocate of that athlete, whether it's a sibling, a really good friend, even if that really good friend's not an athlete, someone who can help that athlete be them, their authentic selves, and explain the situation. And I think through just a discussion like that, that will probably solve 3/4 of the issues that are at hand, and maybe everyone would walk away with a better understanding of what the actual issues are, and they may not be what they seem.
Hey, Jeremy, I want to stop you. It's a great point. I just want to stop you and kind of come back to that for a second. I've seen this repeat a lot of times, as you said, that sometimes the athlete is outgrown the sport. They're not as engaged with the sport, but it's the parents' connection to the athlete through sport. I've seen that a lot. I've seen it at least anecdotally with the opposite sex parent. Is there any research that backs that up, or is it just sort of a catch-as-catch-can, is that one parent interacts with the kid through sport and the other interacts more broadly, or maybe doesn't interact more broadly? Can we consign that to gender roles, or can we, not to say that fairly or flippantly, or is it something that is just there?
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of research on this and none that I can identify right now, but I know I've come across it before and I've read it, and it's definitely been done. But I think in this case, it's more about connection with the child itself. So if I'm a parent who's absentee for the most part, and I played sports as a youth and my child is in the same sport, And that is really my only connection because I'm not trying to make other connections, or I'm failing at making other connections with my child, I think I would be living through this situation. And the moment that I see anything negative happening to my child, I will want to run in and solve that. And that's also for parents that are fully involved. If that is my connection with the child, because that's what I've been working with them on for 10 or 15 years and all of a sudden it might fall apart, I'm going to want it to try and run in there and solve the problem for them. But people change and people grow. And sometimes people grow in the direction that you as the parent don't necessarily want them to, but it happens. And what are you going to do then? Are you going to force it to go back to the way it was? Are you going to put the toothpaste back in the tube? Or are you going to try to help your child grow in the direction that they need to grow?
Jeff, is there some messaging we could give in this area?
I think parents need to be encouraged to speak up if there is an issue of fairness or of safety.
100%.
But I think that part and parcel with that, we need to redefine what fairness is. Equal playing time is not fairness. Fairness means that, you know what, yeah, your kid is sitting on the bench because his teammate is putting in an extra 6 hours a week in the gym. Or frankly, even if he's not, he's better than your kid. And that's not unfair. You may not like the answer, but it's a completely fair answer. I think we need to have a really tough, hard conversation with parents across the board as to what is and what is not fairness.
That's a great end point of this conversation, because to a lot of us, the joy of sport, the power of sport is that it teaches us to handle and face future adversities. I was told that from the time I buckled the chin strap and started playing anything. So the idea that we play for joy, we play for the future. But sometimes the idea of just the education and the fact that we played, that we went. I always say it this way to parents, and as I met with many of them in my time at Penn State or other places, we're coming up seasonally right in that moment that, you know, every 68 teams go to the NCAA basketball tournament. And only one wins, only one cuts down the net. Success is a one binary here. But do you think any of the teams that go should have said, yeah, I probably should have stayed home. I didn't really want to make that trip. And it ends in defeat for all of them. All 67 others end up walking off the court a loser. But I don't think any of them ever go, yeah, I shouldn't have gone. Nah, I shouldn't have played that game. Some may hate that game for the long time afterwards, but none say they shouldn't have played it. And I think that's really the power of sport. I had a couple more topics while we have this, and this may be timely, and obviously this is a pod, so you may be listening to it a little bit later than when this is recorded. But this week in Washington, nothing good starts after this week in Washington, does it? Really?
Yeah, no, ever.
And I'm talking to at least a cross-border audience here, Jeff. President Donald Trump assembled 50 or so leaders in sport to solve college athletics challenge in an afternoon. I would describe it in two words as a shit show. And I'm not surprised Tiger Woods did not choose to speak during that session. It said a lot more to me, though, as an American, to see how unprepared the American leadership was, the Secretary of State, the vice president, whether the Secretary of State, the Speaker of the House, and the Majority Leader of the Senate were all there talking about this at a time the United States was in a shooting situation. College sports has a lot of problems. I spent a lot of time in that space. We just talked about one for about a half hour, but I wanted to get just some thoughts on Will Leach wrote a terrific column in New York Magazine this week about how Trump ruins everything, the joy of sport, the thoughts of that. And Jeff, I wanted to hit you up for a Canadian perspective on this.
I mean, to say what? Am I surprised that Trump ruins everything? Of course not. We've been telling you that for years. Is it a good idea to have a really blunt, hard-hitting conversation about the nature of university sports in general and where it needs to go? Honestly, yeah. There's a lot of fundamental things that probably need to be addressed sooner rather than later. Is Donald Trump the best person to be leading that dialogue? I'm going to exercise my Canadian right to be polite and sit there and be an observer on that process.
No elbows up, huh?
Yeah.
What's the mood in Canada around the Olympic hockey teams? I know they're a source of pride. I know it's an important sport. Anything that you'd add in this moment?
It's like rubbing a cat the wrong way, dude. What are you doing?
Right. I'm not. I'm asking about feelings in the moment. Because, you know, in the United States, it's still hockey. And the only reason we're talking about it was the slight to the women's team. We really have forgotten that the men's team won the Olympic gold on this one on an overtime goal. But, you know, the idea that the women's team got slighted and it was politicized is really the only story here. Jeremy,
And only in a Trump White House does that even happen.
Yeah. We had a great conversation. It's on YouTube with Doug Logan and Andy Dolich last week about this, and they have some really great ideas. If you're interested in hearing a little more politics and a little less sports, that's another place. And I can't avoid this conversation. I kind of wanted to bring it up only because he was somebody who I thought was very important to me as a somebody I watched growing up. I grew up a Notre Dame fan. Lou Holtz, the legendary coach, and then the University of South Carolina, passed away this week at the age of 89. He led a full life, engaged with his family, with his players, and beloved in many cases by his players. But there are a couple of weird character inconsistencies in Holtz's background, and I wanted to probe them at least today. Holtz is a man who made at least a good part of his living after coaching African-American athletes to play, had a number of moments where he turned kind of MAGA toward the end of his life, and at least maybe philosophically gave a thumb in the eye to his former players. I'm not hearing that from them today. And also he had a record where the NCAA and probations followed him. I certainly have different views of the NCAA at different times, but can we make peace with the foibles of an otherwise terrific coach, kind of keeping in context of our concept of a good coach who expresses views that aren't always perfect or aren't always aligned? Any thoughts on that? How do we remember that in memoriam without totally forcing the cutting out of the legacy?
I think we need to be a whole lot more comfortable with the fact that people are allowed to have different opinions. Just because you don't like an opinion doesn't mean that they aren't allowed to have an opinion. Just because you find an opinion offensive doesn't mean that they're not allowed to have that opinion. There can be consequences for those opinions, absolutely. But the minute that we are not allowed to have negative or offensive or contrarian opinions to what other people think, count me out.
Jeremy, is there a way to deliver those opinions in a way that they're not offensive?
Well, I think having a discussion about that and why people feel that those opinions are necessarily wrong without everyone wanting to start a dumpster fire. Whether they're on the end of what they're saying or if they're on the other end where they're receiving it. You know, there's a lot of polarization happening right now. And a lot of times it's just sitting down and having a discussion. And a lot of times it's understanding where the person's coming from, not even what they're saying, just where they're coming from and why it may be so upsetting for them to better understand, you know, the way forward and how we can move forward, not only in that specific conversation, but in a relationship or two countries or the entire world moving forward together. There has to be a way to do it. And starting dumpster fires and tossing hand grenades into rooms and continuing to walk by is not the right way to do it.
One of the most important lessons I've learned in my life and try to adhere to is don't escalate everything. And it's one of the acts of maturity that I'm lucky enough to have finally grasped, is that take nothing personally and try not to escalate everything, because people have reasons that haven't included you and may be very much their own, They also may have opinions that are not harmful, and you will have a better understanding of along the way. But I appreciate this conversation, largely aimed at coaching, but also aimed at messaging around coaching, understanding the complexity of the coaching relationship. And that's really what our job is here on Leaders Under Fire in Sports. Jeff, I wanted to give you one last word. If you're a leader who's been through this, I like to say that in kind of playing off Holtz, he used to say there are only two kinds of coaches, them that's been fired and them that are going to be. I had a secondary theory in my background. There are only two kinds of coaches, those who've been investigated and those who are going to be. Everybody's going to be called into question. How do you talk to a coach who's going to come back to a team or a program after there was an investigation? If they were cleared in large measure, if they were cleared in part, but maybe not altogether, or maybe even altogether cleared, how do they come back and put that back together? I know that's one of Jeremy's topics, but Jeff, from a messaging standpoint, what do you say on the first day back?
You do it with dignity. If there's something that you probably could have done better, then this is your opportunity to play the better part and to be the bigger person and to say, you know what, this is what I've learned. I said this in this way. Really, I could have said it in this way, and that would have saved a lot of problems. If you've gotten absolutely 110% exonerated, as in you've done absolutely nothing wrong, you smile, you go, great, let's focus on the future. We're not here to dwell in the past. We're here to get down, come together as a team and push forward.
Jeremy, this is in your area of expertise. Let's give you the last word.
Well, I just want to say this because this has come up a lot recently in the news, especially in the U.S., is, was the person not actually guilty of doing something, or were they cleared? And that's really a way to look at something was, did they do the right thing morally, ethically, and legally, or did they do some things that they probably shouldn't have done, but they couldn't have found them guilty of anything specific because maybe it's not written in a law book yet. But in either case, like Jeff was saying, communication is key, right? Like, you have to communicate and you have to make sure that everyone is able to move forward, because something happened, a case or an investigation, it's found that, okay, we can move forward. Nothing really happened, or nothing happened where we're going to say anything about it and we're going to move forward. Is everyone going to be able to move forward, or is there going to be lingering issues that are involved? And that's why communication is the most important thing in order to reestablish that trust or build a new trust, is communication. Is the coach or the athletic director just going to ignore what happened, or are they going to address it? And I think that's the biggest thing here is how to address it for this coach in the beginning of this episode that we're talking about. When the coach does come back to coaching this team, is he or she going to address the situation, or are they going to pretend that it never happened and not get to say a word about it? And then everyone's really wondering what happened, where they stand, what they saw, and that now it's not going to be addressed.
It takes humility and communication to kind of bring that back, doesn't it? I mean, we've talked a lot about this. This is one of our maxims collectively, that any culture that's gotten off base and off cycle needs to affirmatively be put back. There needs to be an ameliorative statement putting it back. And I think that's something we all believe in. Until the next time on the pod of Leaders Under Fire, we leave it with leaders needing to be able to fix the mistakes that get made, and they need to do it with honesty, humility, and good communication, and certainly never retaliation or lack of grace. I had the two best partners in this. He's Jeremy, Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. He's Jeff Chatterton, as the crisis communications expert. And I'm Bob Boland, the lawyer. investigator and professor, and we're here to talk to you every regular session under Leaders Under Fire in Sports here at Culture in Sports. Thank you.
You've been listening to Leaders Under Fire in Sports by Culture in Sports. These moments under pressure don't just shape headlines, they shape people. They shape organizations and the cultures they leave behind. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jeff Chatterton, joined with Bob Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, and our special guests as we've examined what leadership looks like when it truly matters. If this conversation challenged the way you think about leadership in sports, we invite you to continue to learn with us at cultureinsports.com. Because influencing positive change starts with how leaders respond when they're under fire.